Mr. X, a novel by Peter Straub, read by Keith Sarabica. How I Came Home and Why. Stupid me. I fell right into the old pattern and spent a week pretending I was a moving target. All along, a part of me knew that I was hitching towards southern Illinois because my mother was passing. When your mother's checking out, you get yourself back home. She had been living in East Cicero with two elderly brothers above their club, the Panorama. On weekends, she sang two nightly sets with a house trio. When she could no longer ignore her sense of fatality, my mother kissed the old brothers goodbye and went back to the only place I'd be able to find her. Star had been 18 when I was born. A generous, large-souled girl with no more notion of a settled life than a one-eyed cat. And after I turned 4, I bounced back and forth between Edgerton and a parade of foster homes. My mother was one of those people who are artists without a specific art. She apprenticed herself many times over to painting, writing, pottery, and other crafts, as well as to the men she thought embodied these skills. I lived with 6 different couples in 4 different towns, but it wasn't as bad as it sounds. The best of my 6 couples, Phil and Laura Grant, the Ozzie and Harriet of Naperville, Illinois, were almost saintly in their straightforward goodness. Before I went to Naperville, now and then I did go back to Cherry Street, where the Dunstans lived in their various old houses. Aunt Nettie and Uncle Clark took me in as though I were an extra piece of luggage Star had brought along. For a month, maybe 6 weeks, I shared a room with my mother, holding my breath and waiting for the next earthquake. After I moved in with the Grants, this pattern changed, and Star visited me in Naperville. She and I had come to an agreement. My mother loved me, and I loved her. But no matter how much she loved me, Star didn't have it in her to stay in one place longer than a year or two. She was my mother, but she couldn't be a mother. Star usually showed up in Naperville just after Christmas, and almost always right at the start of summer, after I got out of school. But she never came on my birthdays. Birthdays were when my problem came down on me, and my problem made her feel so rotten, she didn't want to think about it. I think I always understood this, but it didn't make conscious sense, a sense I could use, until 2 days after my 15th birthday. I came home from school to find waiting on the hall table an envelope addressed in my mother's back-slanted handwriting. It had been mailed from Peoria on my birthday, June 25th. Balloons, streamers, and lighted candles floated above an idealized suburban house. Inside, beneath the printed happy birthday, she had written the only message she ever put on one of her cards. My beautiful boy, I hope, lots of love, Star. I knew that her wishes weren't for our happy birthday, but an untroubled one. A half second after this insight opened the door, the first adult recognition of my life slammed into me, and I saw that my mother slighted my birthdays because she blamed herself for what befell me then. She thought I got it from her. My birthdays made her feel guilty. In khaki shorts and polo shirts, the Grants were monitoring the progress of herbs and vegetables in their garden. In the moment before they noticed me, I experienced the first in about a month of those "what's wrong with this picture" moments, an animal awareness of my incongruity in this sweet suburban landscape. Danger, shame, isolation, exposure. Me and my shadow. There we were. Laura glanced at the card, then back into my eyes. Star could never forget your birthday. Can I see it? Both Grants liked my mother, though they liked her in different ways. When Star came to Naperville, Phil turned out an old-fashioned courtliness he thought was suave, but Laura and I found hilarious. And Laura made room to talk by going out with Star for an hour shopping. Laura opened the card. Her eyebrows contracted as she read the message. I hope. I hope for that, too, I said. Of course you do, she said, getting it. Phil squeezed my shoulder, getting into executive mode. I don't care what these clowns say. It's a physical problem. Once we find the right doctor, we're going to lick that thing. These clowns were my pediatrician, the Grant's GP, and the half-dozen specialists who had failed to diagnose my condition. The specialists had concluded that my problem was not of organic origin. Another way of saying that it was all in my head. "Do you think I got it from her?" I once asked Laura. "I don't think you got it from anybody. But if you're asking me, does she feel terrible about it? Sure she does. Mothers want to take on anything that could hurt their kids, even the things they can't do anything about." A little while ago, I said that 2 days after my 15th birthday, I came to understand my mother's feelings in a way I could use. And this is what I meant. I learned to ask questions about the things that scare you. That once you are you, that's who you are. And you have to pay the price. Oh, great old ones. Read these words inscribed within this stout journal by the hand of your devoted servant, and rejoice. I always liked walking late at night. In a comfortable city like Edgerton, the enormous blanket of darkness cushions even the sound of your footsteps on the pavement. I drift down Hatchtown's narrow lanes and look up at shuttered windows I could pass through in a second, but do not. During my rambles, I avoid street lamps. I am dressed in a black coat and hat, a moving shadow, invisible in the darkness. I subtracted from the world. The gangly hooker and stacked high-heel sandals, and a skirt the size of a washcloth. I looked at the pinpoint dots of her pupils, and let her pull me toward the doorway, opened her up like a can of sardines, and broke her neck before she remembered to scream, poor baby. Let us not forget the actual baby I found abandoned atop the dumpster, and assisted in its departure from an inhospitable world by detaching its darling little hands and excising its outraged little eyes. Great beings, as I walk unseen through the city, the flow of information brings with it the promise of that destiny for which I have waited since I was a boy taking lessons from the foxes and owls in Johnson's Woods. In my city's secret corners, I already see runners of the blue fire. It gathers itself for an electrifying moment along the rain gutters on Cherry Street, where the surviving Dunstans eke out their blasted lives. Around our tiny illuminated platform, suspended in the cosmic darkness, the ancient gods, my true ancestors, congregate with rustlings of leathery wings and rattlings of filthy claws to witness what their great-grandson shall accomplish. A most marvelous event has taken place. Star Dunstan has come home to die.
Can you hear me, Slug Spittle?
My dearest hope is that your flesh should blister, that you should feel individual organs explode within you, that kind of thing. Though I shall not be able to manage these matters on your behalf, my old sweetheart, I shall do my best to arrange them for our son. Right from the beginning, I had the sense that something crucially significant, something without which I could never be whole, was missing. My mother told me that as soon as I'd learned to sit up by myself, I used to do this funny thing where I turned around and tried to look behind me. According to Star, Aunt Nettie said, "That boy must think the doctor cut off his tail when he was born." Uncle Clark chimed in with, "He appears to think someone's sneaking up on him." Star told me, "My boy Nettie's smart as a whip. Had he seen if a shadow followed him inside the house?" They shut up, because that was exactly how you looked, like you were trying to find a shadow. When I was 7, I resolved to ask her about the difference between me and other children. In the summer of my 7th year, Star was comfortable and relaxed with her family. For the first time in my life, I heard stories about her childhood and what I had been like as a baby. She helped Aunt Nettie in the kitchen and let Uncle Clark expound without telling him he was a bigoted ignoramus. Being Star Dunstan, she had signed up for a poetry workshop at Albertus, which Uncle Clark called Albino U. 3 days a week, she clerked at the pawn shop owned by her stepfather, Toby Kraft, who, in spite of universal Dunstan disapproval, years before had married Star's mother, Queenie. Toby Kraft had participated in family gatherings for the rest of Queenie's life, and it continued to do so after her death. The occasion for Star's most recent return to Edgerton and my release from the latest set of foster parents. Star's second job involved what she described as modeling a couple nights each week at Alberta's. Our orderly existence permitted me to ask my question. I waited until we were alone in Aunt Nettie's kitchen, me drying the dishes she washed, while Star described a jazz concert she had seen in the Alberta's auditorium a month after my conception. It was a quartet from the West Coast, and this alto player who looked like a stork pushed himself off the curve of the piano and stuck his horn in his mouth and started playing These Foolish Things. And home, Nettie, it was like going to some new place you'd never heard about. It was like hearing the whole world open up in front of me. It was like going to heaven. If I could sing the way that man played alto, Nettie, I'd stop time forever and just keep on singing. When she stopped talking, I said, I really want to know something. Who's my dad? He's an Uncle Clark, is he? She smiled down at me. No, honey, he sure isn't. If Uncle Clark was your daddy, Aunt Nettie would be your mommy. And wouldn't you be in a pickle? But who is he? What happened to him? She seemed to concentrate on scrubbing the plate in her hand. Your father went into the army after we got married. They sent him places ordinary soldiers couldn't go, on a top-secret mission. That's what your father was doing when he died. I could see an American flag on a mountainous promontory, far above silvery water and endless waves, marking the grave of that without which I would forever be incomplete. I wasn't supposed to tell you, but now you're old enough to keep it to yourself. We washed and dried the remaining dishes. I knew that she was in a rush to change clothes and drive to her modeling job, but she stopped and turned around on her way to the kitchen door. I want you to know something else, too, Nettie. Your father isn't the only thing you have to be proud of. Our family used to be important people here in Edgerton. They took most of it away, but folks here remember. You come from a special family. Later that night, my mother woke me up when she let herself into our room. She had carried into the room an odor of smoke and beer mingled with fresh air and summer rainfall, and I tried to sort out these traces of her evening's history as she relaxed into sleep. I crept across and crawled in beside her. Star seemed enormous, a huge female animal still wrapped in the atmosphere of the adventures through which she had passed on her way home. I nestled my back against hers. My body instantly doubled in weight and began to slip toward the center of the earth, where my hero father lay buried. Star shuddered and spoke a single word I trapped in my hand as I plummeted out of consciousness. Reinhardt. At least once a week during my childhood and adolescence, the moment my head hit the pillow, at the whispery pop of the seam, I looked over my shoulder and saw a shadow fleeing down sunny Cherry Street. I ran to the corner and saw my shadow floating like a solid substance above the sidewalk ahead. When I pounded forward, the sidewalk tilted like a slide, and the familiar houses and dark porches softened in the heat. Edgerton was gone. I ran down a beaten track leading to a narrow river and an arched wooden bridge. My shadow moved up the arch of the bridge, leaned on the curved iron railing, and faced me without having turned around. You seem to be trying to catch me, my shadow said. I need you, I said. And you better come along. By the time I reached the top of the arch, the shadow was far down the descending slope. The iron handrails had become slim and delicate, and the planks bent beneath my weight. The shadow patted the railing. The longer it gets, the thinner it becomes, like toffee. In the end, it disappears. We need each other, I said. We're the same thing. You're me and I am you, yes, said the shadow. But only in the sense that we each have qualities the other lacks. Unfortunately, your qualities are boring. You won't even be able to go out by yourself at night for another 6 or 7 years. When do we have our first cigarette? Our first drink? When do we get to have actual sex? He shook his head in disgust. I want darkness. I want night. A little grown-up fun. With you, it's going to be too much work to get them. Without me, you can't get them at all, I said. On the contrary, without you, I can do whatever I like. If you catch me, I have to come back. But I won't be easy to catch, and you'll be in considerable danger during the pursuit. What kind of danger, I asked. That kind, for one. He swept his arm toward the forest. Imaginary blue fire flickered from branch to branch. My heart went cold, and my mind became a stone. 4 years before the dream I just described started wrecking my sleep two or three nights every month, my aunts and uncles had seen conclusive proof of their doubts that Star could produce an undamaged child. I had been looking forward to my third birthday. The aunts and uncles, my grandmother and my mother, must have spent much of the morning preparing the scene. Someone had blown up the balloons and used a big ladder to fasten them to the clotheslines. A paper tablecloth printed with birthday cakes and candles had been stretched across the picnic table. Star made lime jello in the birthday cake, angel food with chocolate frosting. I can remember Toby Kraft, his face so white he reminded me of Casper the Friendly Ghost, strutting around the table and patting people on the back. It begins with a sudden awareness of the warmth and color of the light. I saw the brightness gather in a shining skin on the backs of my mother's hands. Then the earth opened beneath me, and I plummeted downward and away from the picnic table. I came to rest and found myself in a large, untidy room. Books covered a table and stood in piles on the floor. In the distance, an embittered voice ranted about smoke and gold. My eyes fastened on the mantel, where a fern drooped beside a fox stepping delicately toward the edge of a glass dome. The weights of a brass clock swung this way, that way, on the other side of the fox's confinement. I had been pushed back. I was in the museum of the past. It ended so quickly that I did not have time to react. In the space between two halves of a second, I had traveled at enormous speed back to my chair at the picnic table, restored to the present. Uncle James was still telling the same joke to Uncle Clark, Aunt May still smiling her compliments to her fried chicken. "You scrambled off the picnic bench," Star told me, not once but many times, retelling the story to help herself deal with it. "I asked if anything was wrong, but you just put your hands over your eyes and started running. Then you fell down flat and stiffened up like a board. The spasms hit you so hard you bounced off the ground. Foam was coming out of your mouth. When I got my arms around you, I couldn't even hold you still. Then you went limp. I picked you up and put you to bed. After a while, Aunt Nettie and Aunt May came in to feel your forehead and tell me about everybody they ever knew who had fits. The doctor said it could have been anything." I never told Star what happened during my attacks. It was bad enough that other people saw me thrashing on the ground. It would have been worse if they had known what was going on inside. Even now, thinking about this is like trying to reconstruct a half-destroyed mosaic. The internal story of my third birthday cannot ever be reconstructed. The path to wisdom leads downward, and anyone who decides to take it had better buckle on armor, remember to bring a sword, and get used to the idea that when and if he gets back, everyone he talks to is going to think he's a phony. It would have looked like this. Through walls of blue fire, I follow a being into the ordinary world, and we are standing before a house with a basketball hoop hung over the garage door and a bicycle canted over its kickstand at the edge of the driveway. I can see a street sign, but since I am three, I cannot read. The being beside me frightens me like Aunt Nettie's stories of the boogeyman. The brim of his black hat shades his face. His coat nearly touches the ground. In my terror, I turn away and see the dark shapes of mountains rising like animals into the sky. The air smells like Christmas trees. The being moves forward. He turns to the front door and moves onto a welcome mat. Gleeful flames swarm around him. He pushes the doorbell. Then I am within the being and looking horrified through his eyes. I see a blue-white hand pull a knife from the depths of the black coat. Flame moves along the blade. The unopened door is a blue tissue. On the other side of the shimmering tissue, a heavy-set man in jeans and a sweatshirt approaches. When the man opens the door and thrusts himself forward, I try to wrench free of the being. I try to scream. We follow the man through the door and the blue fire surges in with us. He bends to get away and we bend with him. His teeth shine milky blue. The knife slides into the band of flesh between the bottom of his sweatshirt and the waist of his jeans. We lean into him so closely that our chin rubs his cheek. We are in a dance. We move behind him and pull up on the knife. A sheet of blood cascades over his jeans. A silver rope emerges. Another rope slides out. I feel a relaxation around me and break free. The man lowers his hands to the ropes and holds them as if making an offering. Slowly he tries to move the ropes back inside his body. The being says, "Mr. Anscombe, I presume." The being leans down, sets the knife hard against the side of the man's neck, and jerks it across. Black fluid streams over the sweatshirt. The being steps back. Beneath the shadow of his hat, a blank pane of darkness ends in a strip of jaw. I understand. He is Mr. X. Down the side of the room, blue flames swarm across the wall and form a glowing transparency, through which I can see a woman in a nightdress sitting on a bed with a little girl on her lap. She holds a book but has stopped reading to look at the place in the wall where the door must be. Mr. X strides ahead, into the bedroom. The girl buries her face in her mother's chest, and the mother hoists her up. "I want you to get out of here right now, whoever you are," she says. She backs against the wall and shouts, "Mike!"
"Mrs. Anscombe," he says, "tell me, don't you find it awfully dull out here in the sticks?"
"My name isn't Anscombe," she says. "You're making a terrible mistake." He comes toward her. She springs onto the bed. Mr. X wraps a hand around her ankle. She releases the little girl and shouts, "Run, baby, run outside and hide!" He yanks the woman off the bed and kicks her in the stomach. The little girl stares at him. He flicks a hand at her, and she shuffles an inch forward on her knees.
"Too cold outside for a nice baby," he says. "Dangerous. Baby might meet a big bad bear."
"Do anything you like to me," the woman says. "Just don't hurt my baby. She doesn't have anything to do with why you're here. Please."
"Oh," he says, "why am I here?"
He knocks her to the floor. He bends down, grabs her hair, and hauls her to her feet.
"Isn't there a little boy in the Anscombe family?"
"He's gone," she says. "I don't know where. You don't have to hurt my baby."
"I wouldn't hurt an innocent child."
He summons the girl. She creeps across the blanket and he scoops her up.
"But I often wonder why the very people who should know better think that this is a benign universe."
He anchors the child in the crook of his elbow, grips the top of her head, and twists. There is an audible snap. The child sags. I don't want to go on. It's all wrong anyhow. I kept mixing up the details because the actual memory was too painful. That time the name wasn't Anscombe. Anscombe came in later.
It took me an absurdly long time to understand who and what I was. You, my masters, had it easy by comparison. And I beg you to understand the nature of my struggle. Until I reached that cataclysm known as adolescence, my impersonation of an ordinary child met with passable success. The word creative came in handy, although I failed to appease the mothers of Maureen Orth, whom I talked into letting me strip naked and tie to a birch tree in Johnson's Woods when we were in the eighth grade. The pathetic screams induced by the sight of my penknife led me to untie. In the end, my father wrote Mr. Orth a check for $1,000, and that was that, apart from the grumbling. My mother forbade me ever again to go into Johnson's Woods. Of course, I had no intention of obeying. Johnson's Woods was sacred ground to me. The woods were mine, not because they belonged to my family, but because they had spoken to me the first time I really looked at them. I must have been transported past Johnson's Woods hundreds of times before I looked through the rear window of the school bus and felt a fishhook strike my heart as a voice out there inside my head boomed, "Come to me. You need me. You are mine. Be with me. Whatever." Blessedly, the next day was Saturday. With premature cunning, I told my mother that I thought I'd ride my bike for a while. On my usual Saturdays, I wandered down Manor Street in a black, bored rage, scratching the sides of our neighbor's cars and crouching under a bush to shoot passing dogs with my BB gun. The second I got out of sight, I stood up on the pedals and made that clunker fly. At the place in the road where I'd felt the tug and heard the wondrous voice, I dragged the bike behind a tree and stood up straight, knowing I was in the right place. The place I was supposed to be. The trunks of many trees filled my vision. Brown, gray, silver, some almost black. The trembling pools of light lay across the gray-green floor. The air was a floating, silvery gray. Then, as if they had come into being all at once, I could see the squirrels everywhere, leaping from branches, landing on twiggy shoots, then swaying downward to rocket up again in an endless chase. Birds of all descriptions crisscrossed the gauzy air. A fox materialized within a cube of empty air, pricked up its ears, and stopped moving with one paw still raised. On the last Sunday before summer vacation, I saw the first faint traces of the blue fire and knew that the summer would be a time of wonders. I reached the last of the trees. Before me was a grassy oval, unnerving the quiet. As soon as I moved out from beneath the canopy, the temperature heated up but good. I could hardly see in all that brightness. When I breathed in, the clearing breathed with me. An electric current ran up my arms and into my chest. A bluebird ventured out of the woods, and I tracked its arrogant overhead loop. Within, my newborn self spoke, and I sent a thought flying to the bluebird. As quick as anything, that bluebird crumpled its wings and fell, lifeless as an anvil. On the way home, I tried to do the same to a crow sneering at me from a telephone wire. The blasted thing refused to drop dead. I had no better luck with Sarge, an elderly police dog twitching in sleep on his owner's front lawn. I had been given a tool that had come without an instruction manual. Thinking as a child, I assumed that installments of the instruction manual were to be steadily delivered over a reasonable time. Little did I know. Because my board scores were surprisingly good, I wound up being accepted by all four of the colleges I applied to. I decided on Middlemount College in Middlemount, Vermont, and my life began to unravel. When my jock roommate followed his instantaneous loathing of everything I represented by crowding great numbers of his prep school chums into our room night after night to yell about fags, niggers, kikes, car wrecks, sailing catastrophes, broken backs, broken necks, I complained loudly enough to get reassigned to a single room. In spite of my SAT scores, my math and science courses seemed to be conducted in a foreign language. Sometimes I looked up from my desk at a string of gibberish Professor Flagship, the calculus teacher, was scrolling across the blackboard, and felt myself fall through a hole in the Earth's crust. I spent whole weeks doing nothing but shoveling between the dorm, classrooms, and the library. And then it started to get cold. The temperature sank to 20 degrees, and the cold gripped my skin like a claw. Daily, second by second, I was being erased into a shadow. The one thing that kept me from feeling as though I already had become a shadow was my guitar, and what happened when I played it. For my 12th birthday, which had not failed to be marked by the usual horror show, the Grants had given me a nice old Gibson, along with what turned out to be years of lessons from a sympathetic teacher. I brought my guitar with me to Middlemount, and now and then, when my room closed in around me, I went to a corner of the dorm's lounge and played there. The happy result of my playing was the renovation of my public identity from that weird Ned guy who never comes out of his room to that freaky Ned who can play really good guitar once he gets out of his room. At Christmas break, I went back to Naperville and acted as though everything was fine. I realized that I had been more homesick for Naperville and the Grants than I had been willing to admit. The day after Christmas, I heard a car turn into the driveway,
and went to the living room window to watch Star wheel up to the garage in a handsome old Lincoln. She emerged wearing high heels, an elaborate hat, and a black coat too light for the cold. She put her arms around me, and the Grants both started talking at once, and I could feel her begin to calm down. The next morning, Laura and Star went out shopping, and Star came home with a new coat from Beagleman's, purchased at 60% off, because Mr. Beagleman thought it would never look as good on anyone else. As Laura told the story, she gave me a sideways look. "Did you boys stay home all the time we were out?"
"You bet," Phil said. "We had a hell of a time kicking out the dancing girls before you got back."
My mother drifted into the living room. Phil cleared his throat and challenged Star to their annual Christmas chess championship. I followed Laura into the kitchen. She leaned against the sink. "I thought I knew you pretty well, Ned, but now I'm beginning to wonder."
"About what?"
"Did you leave the house while we were gone?"
I shook my head.
"What's going on?"
Laura was still searching my face.
"Star's worried about you."
"There's nothing to worry about. You thought you saw me in Beagleman's?"
"There's a little more to it. Mr. Beagleman came up to help and I walked away. When I looked back, your mother was gone. Then I looked through the window and there she was, out on the sidewalk in that coat. She was talking to you."
"Me?"
"That's how it looked. Star seemed so unhappy, so disturbed.
You, the person I thought was you, turned his back on her and walked away. I did ask her about it on the way home."
"What did she say about the guy?" "First, she said there wasn't any guy. Then she said, oh, she forgot. A stranger came up and asked for directions. And then she cried. But it wasn't you, so I made a mistake. Obviously."
"I guess so," I said.
Over lunch, the astonished Phil explained the Machiavellian stratagems by which my mother had sandbagged him in chess. Star ate half of what was on her plate. She had a long drive ahead of her. "Time to go. Thanks so much. Goodbye." By the time I carried her bag downstairs, she was giving Laura a hug. I walked her down the path to the Lincoln. She wrapped me in her arms.
"Come with me, Ned. Throw a few things into a suitcase and tell those nice people you're going to stay with me while you think things over."
I pulled back and looked at her.
"What?"
She was serious.
"I have enough room to put you up."
I shook my head in bafflement.
"What's going on?"
"I want to protect you."
I couldn't help it.
I laughed at her. Middlemont's a lot safer than a nightclub in the middle of Cleveland. I felt her arms and shoulders tremble as she kissed my cheek. I almost decided to climb into the old Lincoln and drive away. Middlemont College closed around me like a fist. In the week before finals, I sank deeper into the old pattern, rushing under metal skies between classes in the library, often falling asleep with my churning head on an open book. On Wednesday night, I fell asleep at my desk. Raps at the door jolted me awake. When I opened it, I was startled to see Simone Feigenbaum, a girl from my French class. Simone was from Scarsdale. She smoked chitons and was in the Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen crowd. She flowed in and put her arms around me. In the midst of a lengthy kiss, she pulled down my zipper and reached for the sly comic bravado within. My clothes windmilled away, and hers flew off over her head. We toppled into my narrow bed. Instantly, Simone Feigenbaum was zooming over, under, alongside my body, her breasts in my face, then her stomach, then her buttocks. Then her face was in my face, and both of us were working away like pistons until I seemed suddenly to turn inside out. Her breasts nudged my face, and I got hard without ever actually getting soft, and we did everything all over again, only slower. And so on, repeatedly, until my thighs ached and my penis was waving a limp white flag. I was 18, and a virgin besides, technically speaking. Around 6 in the morning, Simone slipped out of bed and into her clothes.
"Simone, why did you come here?"
"I had to make sure I screwed you at least once before you flunked out." The calculus exam was 22 hours away. Professor Flagship strolled from chair to chair, handing out thick wads of paper covered with mathematical formulae. This is a multiple-choice examination. Check off the answers and use the blue books for calculations. To me, he added, I wish you luck, Mr. Dunstan. I believe that I had a dim grasp of the first few problems. All the rest were in a mixture of old Icelandic and Basque. I watched my hand add a caricature of Professor Flagship's face to the body of a lion with stubby wings, protruding breasts, and a bloated penis. I opened a blue book to a fresh page and in neat block letters wrote, The main cause of problems is solutions. I tossed my test papers on the professor's desk. The Saturday after final exams, the campus was filled with parents picking up their sons and daughters. The Grants expected me to come into O'Hare on Sunday afternoon. I was to call them Saturday to confirm. I put in a collect call to Naperville and spoke an escalating series of whoppers about an invitation to join a friend in Barbados, and if they didn't mind. The Grants said they'd be sorry not to see me, but spring vacation wasn't far away. How'd the finals go? Phil asked. We'll see. I know my Ned. You're going to surprise yourself. The next morning, transparent sunlight streamed down from a sky of clear, hard azure. Accompanied by my own crisp shadow, I walked into Middlemount and wandered around, sipping at a container of coffee and biting into an apple Danish. I walked back to the college and, at a crucial junction, experimentally turned left instead of right, and soon found myself at the edge of what appeared to be an extensive forest. Weather-beaten letters on a wooden sign nailed to the trunk of an oak read, Jones's Woods. At the time, all I understood was that if I walked in the woods, I would feel better. So I left the road and walked into the woods. I seemed to be magically at home, or if not precisely at home, at least in the right place. My anxiety had dwindled. I had to leave college. That was all right. I could marry Simone Feigenbaum and be a kept man. Eventually, the light began to die, and the trees crowded closer together. I stood up and walked out. Tuesday afternoon, I sat frozen at the base of a giant oak and attended to the deep, nearly inaudible sound as of powerful machinery at work, filtering up through the snowpack. Snatches of high-pitched music resounded either from the air itself or from the movement of the air through the branches. The music-laden air filled with grains of darkness. The grains coalesced, and the darkness blotted out the light. Wednesday morning, I saw my guitar case propped beside the door. The sight immediately suggested the inspiration of adding to the music of Jones's Woods. I jumped out of bed. Having breakfasted on sour milk and Cape Cod potato chips, I entered the glum post office and found an official envelope pressed against the glass window of my box. I opened the envelope and read, Mr. Dunstan, Professor Roger Flagship demanded that I inspect the three blue books which you submitted to him upon conclusion of the final examination in introductory calculus. Not only had you failed the exam by correctly answering only 12 out of 100 questions, you had subjected both his course and himself to mockery. Professor Flagship drew my attention to several obscene caricatures of himself contained within the blue books. After thoughtful consideration, I ask you to report to a January 20th meeting at 7:30 a.m. with any records, along with evidence of previous psychiatric treatment, which might assist me in protecting your position here at Middlemount College. I am sending a copy of this letter to your guardians, Mr. and Mrs. Philip Grant of Naperville, Illinois. Sincerely yours, Clive McAnudo, Dean of Student Affairs. I blew my nose on Clive's letter and pitched it into the wastebasket, more disturbed by his sending it to the Grants than by my imminent expulsion. Phil and Laura would understand that what I was doing was vastly more important than the pabulum dished out in my classes. Back at the center of the universe, Jones's Wood, after an hour's silent meditation had permitted me to hear the music in the air, a gathering sense of being as yet not absolutely in the right place caused me to get back on my feet and move deeper into the woods until I came upon the ruins of a cottage. I creaked open the door and beheld the rotted wooden walls, the single broken window, a litter of feathers, tiny skeletons, and dried animal feces on the dirty floor, and knew that here it was at last, the right place. Steady music flowed to the cottage, produced by the wind hissing through the gaps in the timbers. Just before dark, I ran to my room for blankets and provisions, and hurried back while I still had light enough to see. The cottage emerged from the surrounding darkness like a tall shadow in the sacred woods. When I entered, I seemed instantly to plummet through the rotting floor. I fell. I saw nothing. I did not fear. A long, shabby, once handsome room took shape before me. Out of my range of vision, a man spoke of smoke and gold and corpses on a battlefield. On the mantel over the fireplace stood a dying Boston fern, a stuffed fox advancing within a glass bell, and a brass clock with weights revolving left-right, right-left, left-right. This was backward. It was past. And I had been here before. Before I vomited, the world melted and restored itself, and the contents of my stomach drizzled onto the ruined floor. Home, I thought. While still presentable enough to go into town, I stocked up on canned food and camping equipment. After I realized that I could make use of the fireplace, I bought bags of charcoal briquettes. Some nights, raccoons climbed through gaps in the flooring and fell asleep like dogs in front of the dwindling fire. Toward the end of my 45 days in the cottage, when going into town would have invited arrest or hospitalization, forest music, nature music, planet music took up my time. My cold turned into pneumonia, and I took the fever, sweats, and exhaustion for signs of grace. Everyone else feared that the loss of my scholarship had driven me to suicide. Phil and Laura flew to Middlemount and participated in the search for my hypothetical remains. When the local police finally found me slumped over my warped guitar and picking at its two remaining strings, they unceremoniously rolled me onto a stretcher. 2 days later, when Laura left my bedside and went back to the Middlemount Inn for a nap, I checked out of the hospital, went to the bus station, and vamoosed. From then on, I kept moving. I had jobs in grocery stores and bars and shoe stores. 3 or 4 times a year, I called the Grants and tried to convince them that my life had not dwindled into failure. In 1984, Phil, a lifelong non-smoker, died of lung cancer. I went to his funeral and spent a couple of days in my old room, staying up late and talking with Laura. She seemed more beautiful than ever before. Sometimes we clung together and wept for everything that could not be undone. 2 years later, Laura told me that she was remarrying and moving to Hawaii. Her new husband was a retired lawyer with a lot of land on Maui. Just before I turned 26, I got a job in telephone sales for an infant software company in Durham, North Carolina, and did well enough to get promoted into a job where I more or less had to enroll in a programming course at UNC. Not long after, the company made me a full-time programmer. 3 years after I took the programming job, the software company relocated to New Brunswick, New Jersey. For the first time in my life, I had a little money in the bank, and once I got to New Brunswick, New York started flashing and gleaming in the distance, beckoning me to the party. 2 or 3 nights every month, I took the train to the city and stopped in at restaurants and jazz clubs. Eventually, I started calling a few software outfits in New York, and 2 years after moving to New Jersey, I got a better job, packed up, and went to the party. On my birthdays, I called in sick and stayed in bed. And then, in the midst of my orderly life, I started getting this feeling about my mother. It began as a kind of foreboding. A few months after moving to New York, I telephoned Aunt Nettie to ask if she had heard anything from Star. "No," she said. "How about you?" I told her I'd been worried. She told me that my mother was in East Cicero, whooping it up with two old rascals. "Star is going to let us know if she needs help. She won't have to be told to get here as fast as she can. She'll just know. A streak of second sight runs through the Dunstans, and Star has her share. You do too, I think." "Second sight? That's news to me," I said. "You don't know beans about your own family, that's why. They say no one would play cards with my father because he could see what they had in their hands." "You don't really believe that?" She gave a soft, knowing laugh. You'd be surprised at some of the things I believe.